Have you noticed a caravan of black SUVs parking in East Walnut Hills? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on the News Review, we'll talk about how life has changed in that neighborhood since Ohio Senator J.D. Vance became the Republican vice presidential candidate. We'll also discuss what it would take to make Cincinnati's retirement system solvent and hear about recommendations from the city's property tax task force to help homeowners reeling from increased property tax bills. Plus, we'll talk football and what to expect from the Bengals' season opener. Joining me now to kick off the news review is Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Scott.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Always great to have you. So as I mentioned, I think anybody who lives in East Walnut Hills has probably taken notice of those black SUVs. Tell us about the home of Senator J.D. Vance. We don't want you to say the street or address or anything like that, but tell us about where J.D. Vance lives.
I mean, it's pretty unmistakable, though, driving down the road. You can't miss it. There are tents, Secret Service, law enforcement. But it's circa 1867 home that was actually designed by the same architect that designed Music Hall. So it's a pretty distinct house. It's got a lot of history to it. It was, although from what I've read, it was rumored to be on the a stop on the Underground Railroad, but I don't think that's been confirmed. But it's in a neighborhood that has quite a mix of homes, like some middle-class homes and some like incredibly massive manor-like estates. It's heavily wooded, and some of the homes overlook, you can see the downtown skyline, so it's definitely an interesting-looking neighborhood.
So his house is pretty fancy.
I guess it's fancy is a relative term, but I think by any objective measure, it's a pretty impressive house.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the neighborhood of East Walnut Hills for people who aren't familiar with it. What's it like?
It's a pretty good mix of, like, incomes. It's slightly the overall median income. Is slightly above the city average, but you have kind of a mix of, like, really, as I was saying, really rich, wealthy estates right next to, middle-class, working-class homes. So it's a pretty diverse neighborhood. There are, I know there have been efforts, particularly among the main street, the main business district there, to get more businesses there that have there are a lot of new restaurants in the area. Big high school there, Purcell Marion, is there. And I'm trying to think if there's anything, but it's kind of a mix of businesses and different types of demographics.
You spoke to some neighbors. What do they think of Senator Vance and his family? Do they seem to get along well with everybody?
I mean, a lot of the neighbors didn't really want to weigh in one way or the other because, I mean, obviously presidential politics is pretty pretty volatile. But he wasn't really no one had any problems with him. Before he put on the presidential ticket. He was seen occasionally, like with his wife and his dog, walking the neighborhood, but they didn't really see him too often. When he moved into the neighborhood in 2018, I was told J.D. and his wife, Usha, walked door to door through the neighborhood, introducing themselves. They passed out Christmas cards, cookies, and people would see him occasionally, but he really wasn't, no one really got to know him very well. But since he's been named vice president, his motorcade has been seen pretty frequently, and he's been seen, and I personally have seen him in restaurants downtown since then. So I don't know if he's using the house more or not. When I asked J.D. Vance, how often he spends in the neighborhood, he didn't answer that question specifically. But it seems like his motorcade is a common sight now in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I think you mentioned he's been seen at Nolia and over the Rhine and And you mentioned, you know, he is on the Republican ticket now. He's former President Trump's vice presidential running mate. It sounds like, though, life kind of changed for Senator Vance's neighbors even before former President Trump picked him for his running mate. Tell us about the security and what neighbors started noticing.
It was the day of the assassination attempt on Trump. The Governor DeWine, ordered the state troopers, and I guess, I don't know if it was the National Guard, but he ordered security to his street just as a precautionary measure. The neighbors told me that there was law enforcement with assault rifles going up and down the street, something they weren't used to seeing in this neighborhood. It was pretty jarring at first. It's not been that extensive since then. That was, they said, the heaviest security that week. But the security detail has not left since, because then 2 days later, he was officially named the vice presidential candidate, and it's pretty much been black SUVs and law enforcement nonstop parked on the street.
Mm. How often does the street get shut down? You mentioned that motorcade is seen periodically. How often does a whole shutdown of the street happen?
Well, that's a good question. It depended on who I asked. Some residents hadn't really noticed much at all. I mean, I can say I was just walking around there on three separate days, and I saw the motorcade come through once. So my impression is it's pretty frequently now. At least he'll end the night there, or obviously they don't release a schedule of how often he's coming in, but it's not infrequent now. And they tell me that the streets can be closed down for like 15 minutes at a time or so. But they said it's kind of at this point a minor inconvenience. I think they're just concerned that if he does become vice president, obviously that ups the ante. So what is that going to mean? That is at this point open to speculation. I don't have an answer for how that would change, but there is kind of what's our life going to be like if he does become vice president?
Yeah, didn't one of the neighbors say, "Well, I have to give my guests list to the Secret Service if that's the case, if I have a party across the street or something"? Is that some of the stuff you heard from neighbors?
Yeah, it was. I mean, if I want to have people over at my house, are they going to have to go through security? At this point, it's right now they're just dealing with occasionally their driveways are blocked. Everyone has told me, and I can say, like, in my dealings with Secret Service as well, I mean, the Secret Service has been very amenable. They've given them their numbers, their cell phone numbers, like, if you have any concerns. So that people have had nothing but good things to say as far as the Secret Service and the police detail out there. But it is kind of an unknown, because it's a big adjustment. Sure. No one was expecting to live next to a vice presidential candidate and potential, vice president. So everyone is kind of just adjusting, like, okay, so what's this going to mean for me? And at this point, it's all very new there. Because when he was a senator, he was just a senator, was there occasionally, no one really, life went on as normal, but when you're running, when you're on a presidential ticket, there's nothing normal about that anymore.
Sure. Senator Vance emailed you about why he moved to East Walnut Hills with his family and what he likes about it. What did he tell you about why they chose to move there?
Well, as I was describing the house, I mean, it is a pretty gorgeous house, and that was what drew him to the neighborhood. He told me they didn't know much about it. They had not really been there before, but the Samuel Hannaford designed house had a lot of character. It's on a hillside, a wooded hillside that I believe I wasn't allowed up there, but I think it does have some views of downtown from their vantage point. And it was really just the house. And then they said since they've been there, the businesses that have opened up there or that are near there like Cafe Moshiko, which is a Japanese food restaurant, and has become favorites of their kids. So they said the neighborhood's great, but it was the house that caught their attention.
Yeah. Any other favorite places he likes to go that he mentioned in his email to you?
The Bonbonnery, which has been a staple. It's not exactly, it's in a neighboring, I think that's technically O'Brienville. If I get the neighborhoods wrong, I'll hear about it.
Yeah, you will.
But it's close by, and that's been a staple of that area. I mean, that's known for its it's a very well-respected bakery.
Yes. Yes, it sure is.
And I do want to also clarify, too, he does and has since for the last several years, he splits time between there and he also owns a house in the D.C. area of Alexandria, Virginia. And again, how much time he spends in one place or the other, he has not said. But
okay. Well, this has been a fun little peek into how life has changed in East Walnut Hills. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Scott Wortman. Thanks so much for your time today, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Up next, Cincinnati's retirement system has fallen short again. How can it be fixed? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati's retirement system doesn't have enough money to meet its obligations. What would it take to make the fund solvent? Joining me now to talk about that and other important news from the past week are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Hi, Lucy.
Hey, and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzell. Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, let's start with the retirement system. It's one of those things that's really complicated, really important. How many retired City of Cincinnati employees rely on the system?
excuse me. So right now in the retirement system, collecting benefits are about 4,100 former employees. But this is something that covers a lot of our city employees. It does not require, it does not include the police and fire departments. Those are covered by separate pension funds that are in a statewide system. But most other city employees are part of this pension system.
And how does the system get funded?
It is funded from three different sources. One, each employee of the city is sending 9% of their salary into the retirement fund every year. The city of Cincinnati also contributes a percentage of active salaries. That is a minimum of 16.25% per complicated legal agreement because of the problems that the system has had. But more recently, it has been a slightly higher percent. And then the other source of income is this is basically a fund that is invested in the stock market, and there is ideally investment income from that. That also means there's the risk of losing from that fund if investment returns are not positive.
You mentioned problems. I mean, we've been hearing for years that the city's pension system is underfunded. Where does the system stand now?
Right now, this is according to the most recent report of the annual report, which is through the end of 2023. It is 68.8% funded, which means, whatever the other percentage of that up to 100 is not funded.
Yes.
Now, one thing to make clear, which can be confusing, is everyone who's currently receiving benefits is receiving all of their benefits. The concern is 20 years from now, the number of employees that are expected to be in the system who will retire or will still be, currently on the system and may still be on it later, and how much money is expected to be in the account at that time. So everyone is currently getting the benefits that needs them, but the concern is in the future, there's just not enough in the fund to cover everyone that will need it in the future.
And are retired city employees living longer and drawing on the pension longer? Is that a factor with this problem, or is it just that the city hasn't been putting enough money into the fund?
It's both, yeah. So the liability is that has changed. The calculation has changed because folks are living longer. It's a difficult thing to pinpoint because it's not an exact science, right? It's an estimate, and a lot of factors can change that. I mentioned that minimum 16.25% of active salaries that the city has to put in. That's because the city, the pension fund was in trouble, and they did the calculations at this point 10 years ago and said this is the minimum amount you have to put in. But that calculation has changed, and for a long time, the city was still only putting the required minimum in the fund, and it wasn't enough. So now the city is kind of playing catch up, and even if it continues to increase, it's going to need to be a significant amount more money over the next 10 years.
What's the city been doing so far to try to boost the fund?
So the 2 years ago, the budget was the first time the city increased the percent, the salary percentage increase in like 6 or 7 years, something like that, and increased it to 17%. Now it's up to 17.45% or 17.75%. Sorry, I have too many numbers in front
That's
of
okay.
me.
It's Friday.
Yeah. Sorry. 17.75% in the current fiscal year that we're in. So that is beneficial. The other thing that the city did a couple of years ago is every year there is a closeout process of the budget. The finance folks at the city underestimate how much expenses underestimate how much revenue is expected to come in, overestimate expenses. So there's usually some money left over in the closeout budget. And it kind of used to be like a free-for-all, you know, where council would decide what kind of pet projects they want to spend that money on. There is still some of that to an extent, but there's more of a professional process to that in recent years, including up to $2 million will go into the pension fund. So this isn't a percentage of anything. It's just a lump sum. And it's up to $2 million because it's sort of a waterfall process that, you know, it gets a percentage of the closeout funding up to $2 million. It has gotten $2 million in the last two closeout years. They keep saying it won't always be this much. We won't always have this much closeout, but for various reasons, income has come in higher than expected the last couple of years.
What does the Cincinnati Retirement System Board of Trustees want to see happen? What would they like to see the city do to really make this fund solvent a lot faster?
Yeah, well, something they've been asking for a very long time is the city's got to put more money into the system, you know, a higher percentage of salaries. So the increases I mentioned, the board has said we're really grateful for those increases, but they had been asking for a 1.5% increase in that, you know, percentage being contributed, and got, I think, like a 0.8% increase or 0.75% increase instead. So it was something, but not what they had been asking for. So right now they're saying that according to the current projections, which this does change very quickly, the city needs to increase the active salary contribution by 0.9% every year for the next 10 years, 20 years. Excuse me. They also, the board is asking council to kind of put that policy in writing. Right now, what happens is the city administration prepares the budget during budget season. There's hopefully an increase, but if there's not, that discussion just kind of comes up as part of that. What the board would like to see is council to put in some kind of writing, a formal policy that says we commit to increasing by 0.9% every year, but revisiting that policy every 2 years with the biennial budget to say, okay, what has changed? Does it need to increase more this year? Can we get away with increasing it less this year because we had really good investment returns, for example? So they want something in writing that's really that formalizes the commitment to this pension fund.
Yeah, because this has big implications for the city's budget down the road. Now, I know the Futures Commission, this group the mayor appointed to examine the city's financial health and make recommendations, that group had some recommendations about the pension fund. Tell us just briefly what they wanted to see happen and what the retirement board thinks about that.
Yeah, so the Futures Commission idea to fix the pension system is pretty complicated, but the idea is to take Greater Cincinnati Water Works and regionalize it. So it would basically involve selling it, not to privatize the company, it would still be a public entity, but sell it to a new government organization that could sell water to more communities, basically, and that the city could use that sort of lump sum payment to dump it into the retirement system, get that unfunded liability down, increase it to 80 to 85%. Of funded status. And that way, the state retirement system, OPERS, Ohio Public
Employees
Retirement, I should just let you do my job. Thank you.
No.
OPERS. It's just fun to say. So the OPRs, which the city has previously requested that they kind of absorb the Cincinnati retirement system, because the city is the only one in the state that has its own retirement system.
Yeah, and OPRs has
a little weird.
OPRs.
OPRs said,
sorry. Sorry.
You should have warned me that you were going to say that.
Sorry.
That is so good. Anyway, yes, OPRs said nopers. Basically, they said it's too much of a risk. We can't take it on because they have to protect the public employees that are in their system from, you know, all over the state. So that is the Futures Commission recommendation. There are lots of things we could say about that, but not briefly.
Yeah. And it sounds like the Cincinnati Retirement Board is saying, hey, I don't know if that's going to really do the trick. We might need to act faster.
Yeah. So basically they're saying that's a conversation we're open to having. You know, the board is saying we hope we're included in those conversations. But no matter what happens, that's going to take years and years and years to negotiate. And the board is saying even if that does happen down the line, the retirement fund is in crisis right now and it needs to be addressed right now.
Yeah. We did get an email from Gwen. Gwen writes, the city employees, 9% is way too low, but it's interesting that the city is putting in more for its employees. A big mistake the city did was to waste the Humana funds that all should have gone to the pension fund. Full retirement for teachers is 35 years. The city allows retirement at much fewer years. So that's what Gwen thinks. I want to move to you, Nick. Oh my gosh, I've just ripped my headphones off my head. I want to move to you, Nick. Many homeowners are seeing a huge spike in their property taxes this year. We've been following the work of the Property Tax Task Force that Cincinnati City Councilmember Mark Jeffries convened, and that group just offered some recommendations. What were some of the things they recommended in the short term?
Yeah, there's several here, and you know, this is another issue that is kind of a very complicated and involves a lot of money. So let's try to go through them quickly. I think the most immediate thing is the task force is calling for another $1 million to aid homeowners who make less than 80% area median income a year and owe back taxes. So if you already are behind on your taxes and you owe 80% median income, there's $1 million out there right now, less than a million now because some people have claimed some, for help if you live in the city. The task force is saying we need another $1 million because that money's going to run out. And there's about $7 million out there right now that people haven't paid on their property taxes in the city. So clearly, some people could take advantage of that program. So that's like a pretty immediate thing. Another kind of longer term goal, the task force asked how homeowners could save in other ways beyond their property taxes. And one of those answers was energy efficiency. And so our colleague Isabel Nisley did a great story about this proposal to create what they call a green bank, which would be this one-stop place where homeowners or even like organizations could go to learn about how to get these federal subsidies that are coming out to get energy efficiency work done on their house, which could save some people a significant amount of money on their utility bills. That is a tiered kind of program depending on how much money you make. The city would need to kick in about $10 million to be able to access some of those federal funds. Some of that would go toward workforce training to do the energy assessments you need. So that's a really, you know, big part of, I think, their city proposals, the things the city can do. And you can go to WVXU.org and check out Isabel's story for more info on that. I don't want to burn up all of our time on the details, but they're important. So then the other thing that the city can do is create an awareness program to make sure that homeowners in the city are taking advantage of a couple different state programs. One is the homestead exemption for seniors that knocks some money off your property taxes. We'll talk more about that in a second. And the other one is the owner occupancy tax credit, which is if you live in your house and you own it, you can get a tax credit. It's about $78 a year that you could save on average in Cincinnati. So that's not nothing. So those are the citywide things. And then what the city has been saying over and over again, or our council members and other folks, is that the state really has to step in here because there's a lot of state involvement in the property tax rates and how they're assessed and things like that. And so they're backing several pieces of legislation that could someday bring some relief to homeowners. One of them, quickly, is expanding the homestead exemption that I just talked about. Right now, the way it works is if you're a senior and you qualify for the program, if you have a $150,000 house and you get the homestead exemption, you pay taxes on $125,000 of that. So they want to bump it up so that the exemption is $50,000. So if you have a $150,000 house, you pay for $100,000 worth of house, if that makes sense.
Sure.
There are some other ones. One of them is called the circuit breaker tax credit, which if you pay more than 5% of your income into your property tax bill, you would get a tax break. That one is a little more complicated. State Senator Lou Blessing is working on this one, and he says that one would need to be funded somehow. And he has various proposals for how he would fund that. State Rep. Dunny Isaacson is also working on some of these proposals as well. There are a couple others out there. It's unclear what will happen with these. They're not going to pass this session, but they could be reintroduced next session. They likely will be. It seems like there's some interest at the General Assembly level in solving these problems.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a lot of what the working group recommended. They also recommended a process at the county level where when you ask for a sort of like a mediation process for a board of revisions, like when you say, hey, my property taxes are wrong, you need to fix this, having this sort of process where you could go before the board and ask some questions and get ready for your actual hearing to kind of like give homeowners a little bit more of an advantage so that they know what they're doing when they go into the hearing. Because I've heard the hearings like very quick, like, you know, there's lots of people filing these appeals, and if you don't have everything there, you're just not going to win your appeal. So.
Sure. And I've also heard that with the Board of Revisions, your bill might go down, but it might go up. I mean, if there's this kind of, you don't know what's going to happen. So that can be a intimidating process, I think, for homeowners.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a roll of the dice. And I think the suggestion is kind of like, hey, let's get people in these meetings before they go and roll those dice.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, you know, lots of homeowners saw these dramatic increases in their property taxes this year. Remind us how big some of these increases have been and which communities have been hit the hardest by this.
Yeah. So in this story I just did, I saw some numbers that I hadn't seen before, and one of the numbers that really stuck out to me was that 5% of property owners in Cincinnati saw their property taxes double, which is pretty big deal for, I think, a lot of property owners. And then a lot of other people saw 20 to 30% increases or more. So, you know, those are real numbers. A lot of this is also hitting people who might be moderate income or low income, and that's just due to sort of the way these properties were reassessed. Some of them were some people would say undervalued. And so, you know, suddenly they're valued at what they're, you know, quote unquote, supposed to be valued at. And you see this big tax bill. And that's happening in neighborhoods like Price Hill, Bond Hill. There's a long list of neighborhoods that saw their property taxes go up quite a bit on average. And then other neighborhoods saw smaller increases or even decreases.
Yeah. Nick, what's next with this? Where do these recommendations go from here?
So the task force will present these before Cincinnati City Council Monday, September 9th. And from there, it kind of depends on which suggestion you're talking about. The ones at the city level. So this Green Bank and the extra $1 million, some of that could come from the closeout budget overage that Becca talked about earlier, but that's yet to be decided. And then, you know, some of these other things are up to the State House.
Yeah. Well, Becca, I want to come back to you. Hamilton County's recruiting poll workers for Election Day on November 5th. How many does the county need?
This election, it's a bigger need than usual. Of course, it's a presidential election year. Voter turnout is a lot higher than it usually is otherwise. So Hamilton County is looking for about 2,800 poll workers.
Ah, what does it take to be a poll worker?
There are a couple of things that you need to do. First, you obviously just sign up. You do have to be registered to vote and have a valid voter registration. And then you attend a one-time training that is a couple of hours long. Those are scheduled sometimes in the evening, sometimes on the weekends, but you only have to go once. And then after that, you get assigned to a polling place. You do spend a long time at the polling place on election day. You have to be there slightly before polls open and then kind of help tear down after polls close for the day. But for all of that, you do get paid. It's a $225 basically stipend that covers everything from the training to the work on election day. But yeah.
Yeah. And that's a little bit more than what poll workers used to get paid, right?
It is. That's an increase. Hamilton County Commissioners recently approved that increase for poll workers.
Does the county look for political balance of sorts at the polls in terms of people's party affiliation? How does that work?
Yeah, that is a requirement. You don't want poll workers, to have a majority in any one political party at one polling place because it could just raise questions about, you know, anything like that. But so there is a requirement that you have to declare party affiliation to be a poll worker. It's in Ohio, actually, you don't register with a political party like you might in some other states. But to be a poll worker, you do have to declare. Now, obviously, the two main parties, Republican and Democrat, there are certain areas of the county where they need more Republicans, certain areas of the county where they need more Democrats. So for the most part, they try to put you at a polling place close to your home. But if you're willing to drive a little further to kind of help with the political balance, they'd love that, too. But of course, you can declare a third party or independent nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Your reporting was focused on Hamilton County and the need that Hamilton County has for poll workers. But I imagine there are other counties in greater Cincinnati that need poll workers, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, you know, every county and every election is always looking for more poll workers. You know, we do a story like this pretty much every year, twice a year at the primary election. It's a consistent need. You know, a lot of the kind of longtime volunteers or folks that work the polls year after year are older, you know, have more of the time, are retired. So that's a, you know, something that they're always trying to add to that group of folks that they can rely on every election. I did speak to an official in Hamilton County who pointed out a lot of public workers, if you work for a public agency, get the day off and it's paid. You could be a poll worker and get paid again. Those are his words, not mine. But yeah, that's something to keep in mind. If you do get the day off on election day, you know, it might be an opportunity for you to work a poll.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, what does Joe Burrow think about Ja'Marr Chase's contract negotiations? We'll talk football. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Bengals fans are ready to rumble in the jungle. The team's season opener is Sunday at Paul Brown Stadium. And joining me now to talk about what to expect is Bengals Radio Network pregame, halftime, and postgame host, Wayne Box Miller. Welcome back, Wayne.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Well, I'm ready for some football.
I bet you are. Well, as I mentioned, the Bengals play that season opener at Paul Brown Stadium Sunday. The good news for fans is Joe Burrow's healthy, right?
Yes. I mean, after the way last year ended with him having the wrist injury, he looks very good, has looked good all through training camp. I think everyone is excited to see him back on the field and throw the ball the way we know he's capable of, but I think nobody more excited than him to return and lead this team to victory.
Well, am I remembering correctly, is this the first time since his rookie season that he's been healthy like this right at the start of the season?
No, I mean, he had, you know, he was healthy before, and then he had the knee injury in Washington that sidelined him into the season. So not the first one, but certainly good to get beyond a couple of seasons where there were, you know, the appendicitis, I think the calf injury. So he's had some seasons where he started that and then some where he did not. So, you know, every year is new, but I think we're all optimistic that this is going to be a great year.
Well, wonderful. Then there's the not so good news for fans, and that's these contract negotiations between the Bengals and their star wide receiver, Ja'Marr Chase. What do you think is going on there?
It's just business. That's all. Business as usual. And I think much is made of nothing. They're going to get it done at some point. So I don't waste a lot of time with things like that because, number one, I don't write the checks. And number two, none of us really know where the sticking point is, if there is one, or what the numbers are or what is happening. You know, Ja'Marr is going to be a Bengal. That's inevitable. Now, whether that happens today or at some other point, we don't know, but it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know. I'm glad I don't write the checks. Those are some big checks. It's been reported that Ja'Marr Chase wants a contract that matches or tops the deal that Minnesota Vikings wide receiver Justin Jefferson got. Do you think, is Ja'Marr Chase a better player than Justin Jefferson?
You know, it depends on what you're looking at categorically. Is he one of the top receivers in the league? Sure he is. He's an elite receiver. So both of these guys play with Joe Burrow. They're both at the top of their game. And I think that Jamar would probably say he's one and Jefferson's 1A, and I think Jefferson say he's one and Jamar's 1A. So it's, again, you're basically talking about talent at a level that's different from most receivers in the league.
Well, to that end, how important is Jamar Chase to the Bengals, to their game, to the way they play, how they approach football?
A critical piece. I mean, but the other luxury that the Bengals have, they have two number one wide receivers. They have T. Higgins, who's had a great camp, who does what T. Higgins does. Andre Yosibosh has come on really well. Trent Irwin is very reliable. They've got rookies that are playing well. But at the end of the day, when you have T. Higgins and Jamar Chase and a nice tight end room, they've got Jasicki and they've got Eric Ault and they've got Tanner Hudson and, you know, Sample. So they've got weapons. They've got running backs coming out of the backfield. Joe Burrow will find the open guy. So it's not Jamar Chase or bust. It's the open guy, the mismatch that they want to take advantage of, or things of that nature. So I think, yes, you want Jamar on the field. He is a game breaker, a difference maker, but so is T. Higgins. And I think having the luxury of both of them is just incredible. But as long as you have one of them, if there's a delay and, you know, things happening the way you would like, I don't think anyone should panic.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you saying that because I know there's been a lot of talk about the history that Jamar Chase and Joe Burrow have. I mean, going back to their college days, do you think that makes a big difference? I mean, does it make it really important to have both of them healthy and playing, or these other players, can they kind of fit the need there?
Well, you want to be at full strength. I mean, no matter who you are, whether you're the Bengals, the Rams, the Houston Texans, everybody wants to be at full strength. The beauty of the NFL is it's a long season. It's 17 games, and they're all 17 one-game seasons, really. So your focus is just getting through game one, getting through this New England Patriot team who's coming in feeling like nobody gives us a chance so we can be the underdog that upsets the apple cart. So you've got a tough match, and that's the focus of Zach Taylor. That's the focus of the team, is not to be worried about the peripheral, the outside noise, the things that don't put points on the board. And talking about contracts and about who isn't on the field doesn't do anything come Sunday. Those things are merely distractions.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more distracting question, because I read that if the Bengals and Jamar Chase don't reach a deal before Sunday's game, it might not happen this season. Is that how it works throughout the NFL, that negotiations don't continue through the season once the season starts?
Negotiations happen however they happen. And I don't want to sound generic in saying that, but you never know when the deal gets done or when teams decide to finalize the deal. It could be, for all we know, it could be something so minute that once that one thing happens, the deal gets done. It could be a point where people say, let's not distract from the goal and let's do it at the end of the year. It could be when we get to the bye week, let's finalize it and finish it up. So again, I just think that, and this is just my opinion, I think it's too much time is spent on something that you have no knowledge of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly don't have any inside knowledge, that's for sure. How do you think the Bengals defense is looking for this season? The defense had some tough times last season.
Yeah, I think they're looking good there, and they are looking at this as a statement year. I mean, they brought back Von Bell, and they signed Geno Stone to shore up the back end of the defense. Sheldon Rankins is in now. He is somebody's very stout up front to go with B.J. Hill to replace D.J. Reader. Unfortunately, you had the injury to Cam Sample, who was really playing well, but you still have Sam Hubbard and Trey Hendrickson. Joseph Osai is healthy again, who is an excellent rusher, edge rusher, very effective. He battled through some injuries, so it's really good for them. They've got Wilson and Pratt still in place, Akeem Davis Gaither. So they've got veteran experience right behind that front set. And then in the secondary, I mean, you got Dax Hill moving a corner who's had a good camp, DJ Turner, Cam Taylor-Britt. Mike Hilton, who's ever so reliable and a sure tackler. So I think the defense is looking to make a statement. I think they're excited about getting this season underway because so many people focus on the Bengals offense, and rightfully so when you have a Joe Burrow at quarterback. But this defense knows that they play a role in how things unfold as well.
I want to ask you about something else, too, and that's these guardian caps that some players are wearing on their helmets for extra protection. What do you think of those?
Well, I think anything in the name of safety, the NFL and the NFL Players Association can do, they're going to do it. I mean, even a new kickoff rule where now you've got to wait until the ball is either one hitting the ground or two caught by the returner before you can move. It's all to cut down on injuries. And I think that anything they can come up with in the vein of safety and protection, a new tackle rule has gone into place where you can't tackle with your weight, pulling someone down with your weight. The horse collar was added a couple of years ago. So anything that they can do in the name of safety, they're going to continue to do those things. And again, you're talking about a multi-billion dollar brand, and protecting that asset is paramount.
Yeah. Well, I'm a mom and I'm a worrywart, and I'd love to see every player in a contact sport of any kind be able to get some more protection for their heads, for their brains. My understanding is that players will have a choice about whether to wear these during the game. What do you think it might be that could stop some players from wanting to use these?
Well, I think one is what you're used to, what you're comfortable with, what your risk factor is. But at the end of the day, players want to play. They know the risk of football. It's a volatile, violent sport. It always has been. But when you look at football over the years, going back to these players when they were in Pop Warner and Pee Wee League to now, protection has gotten better. It continues to get better. The helmets are better. The shoulder pads and other equipment is designed to help minimize the impact of the collision, the violence. So I think that precautions have always been in place and continue to evolve. You think about football in its inception to now. I mean, it's like quantum leap of protection from no face mask and very little padding to padding and, all kinds of things that players wear for the elbows and shoulders, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, players will wear what is comfortable, and until it's a mandate, they will do what's in the best interest of them playing at their peak performance level.
Yeah. Well, and I guess when you think about what helmets used to look like historically, I mean, they've changed a whole lot over the years in this game, haven't they? I mean, there's really been an evolution of how that has developed.
Well, watch baseball. You want to talk about the evolution, you know, baseball players are wearing a mitt now when they're on the base, and they've got elbow pads, and they've got a wrist pad, and they've got ear protection, and they've got gloves, and they've got a forearm pad. And by the time they get to first base, it's like they're undressing. but, you know, so they're the same way. I mean, everything in the name of protection, if someone can invent it, get it into the league approves it, players will wear it. And if they feel like it helps, then it becomes like anything else. It becomes contagious.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about this season opener with the New England Patriots and how the Patriots are trying to paint themselves as the underdogs. Talking about history, it's really hard for me to wrap my mind around the New England Patriots being underdogs. Do you think they really are the underdogs in this game, or is that kind of a psychological strategy?
No, they are. I mean, it's not a secret. You know, Tom Brady left a couple of years ago, and the first round pick that they had, they traded him already. So they got another first round pick at quarterback. So they're rebuilding. They got rid of Belichick. They got a new coach who played for them, Gerard Mayo. And they are rebuilding. They're, you know, trying to reestablish an identity as a formidable team that will be in the playoff hunt, but I don't think they're at that place yet. And so when you look at where they are versus where the Bengals are, you know, it's a distinct difference. Now, that doesn't mean they can't come in and be disruptive if you take them for granted or you take them lightly, but the Bengals would never do that. I mean, they're just wired to win, and they're wired to respect their opponents, and their players are all wired to be at their best at all times. So it is what it is. they're not the New England Patriots that many people remember when Tom Brady was at the helm and Belichick was the head coach.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the Bengals can beat the Patriots on Sunday?
Yes.
That didn't take long. No hesitation there, huh?
No. And again, it is what it is. The Patriots are in a position of rebuilding and trying to figure out who they are and identify, you know, key components and players. Again, not to take them lightly, but the Bengals are a more talented team, and they've had time to put that talent together and have them work well together.
Yeah. What are the Bengals' big strengths and weaknesses this season?
Obviously their strength is experience. I mean, they've got a lot of players returning. You've got, you know, Chase and Higgins and Burrow returning, so that combination is formidable. They've got an even better offensive line with Trent Brown and Orlando Brown in his second year with Karis, Kapp, and Volson. Nice running backs. I mean, Joe Mixon is gone, but they've got a running back by committee. I think defensively they've gotten better, especially on the back end with Von Bell and Geno Stone. The special teams, you still got Evan McPherson. I think if there's a weakness, and I don't think it's a weakness, I think it's just a matter of understanding how this team comes together as the season goes on, because with Mike Thomas, Joe Mixon, DJ Reader, and Tyler Boyd gone, those were four guys that were leaders in the clubhouse. So I think it's just a matter of the new guys, whoever those leaders would be, and they just elected those captains to just navigate the season and do it in a way that gives everybody the confidence to maintain consistency through the ups and downs of a 17-game season. But I just think that the only weakness would be if they have injuries. So this team is poised to make another deep run. They just have to stay healthy.
Yeah. And in just about 30 seconds, what are your predictions for the season overall? You think the Bengals can go all the way this year?
I think the Bengals can make a deep run, yes. And I think they have everything they need to get to New Orleans and, you know, finish the job. I think that Joe Burrow wants that as bad as any one player has ever wanted it. I think more so because he felt like they were in a position last year and he got hurt. I think this team wants to get back there. And I think they all, as a collective, know and believe that they have what they need to get there. You got to have a quarterback. They got one. You got to have a defensive front. Trey Hendrickson and Hubbard anchor that. And with Sheldon Rankins, they got that. You got to have a back end defense that can prevent the deep ball. They've got that in two players. And they've got game breakers in Higgins and Chase. So they've got a lot of things they need. And lastly, if it comes down to kicking, they've got Evan McPherson.
There you go. We've seen how he kicks. I've been talking with Bengals Radio Network pregame, halftime, and postgame host Wayne Box Miller. Thanks so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May.